It's Tuesday, the 17th of February, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Companies beset by costs are jacking up prices again. Turnover in CEOs is most in over a decade. And farmers are aging. The family business is in peril. Our first article by Ruth Simon, companies beset by costs are jacking up prices again. Higher tariffs, labor, and health expenses force brands to act across many sectors. Companies from Levi Strauss to McCormick, among others, say they're raising prices early this year on items from blue jeans and spices to housewares and industrial products. After holding the line for several months, companies big and small have begun a new round of price increases, in some cases by high single-digit percentage points. Companies had raised prices last year after tariffs pushed up costs, yet in the fall many tabled increases while some offered discounts for holiday shoppers. The pricing break is over. Many companies typically raise prices at the start of the new year, yet increases appear to be stronger than normal for January for electronics, appliances, and other durable goods, said UBS economist Alan Detmeister. Some companies have blamed tariffs for their increases, while others, especially small businesses, also blame higher wages and health insurance costs that they say they can't absorb or share with suppliers. Prices on the most affordable imported goods are up by 2.3% since dipping at the end of November, according to data through February 10th, collected by Alberto Cavello, a Harvard Business School professor who tracks daily online prices at major U.S. retailers. The Adobe Digital Price Index found online prices posted their largest monthly increase in a dozen years in January, driven by higher prices for electronics, computers, appliances, furniture, and bedding. Columbia Sportswear said it's raising prices of spring and fall merchandise by, on average, a high single-digit percent after mostly avoiding increases for fall and winter goods. The company said it also renegotiated prices with its factories and taken other steps to reduce costs. When combined with our other mitigation tactics, our goal in 26 is to offset the dollar impact of high tariffs, Chief Executive Tim Boyle said in an earnings call this month. Such new prices follow last year's wave of tariff-driven increases. Retail prices started falling in October, with the biggest drops before Black Friday, Cavello said. But they started rising again, particularly after Christmas and what looks like a post-holiday reset. Levi Strauss raised prices last month in response to tariffs and is rolling out additional increases this month. Among the items now costing more, ribcage straight ankle women's jeans, priced $10 more at $108, and original fit men's jeans that are $5 more at $84.50. Levi said it has more room to raise prices on newer and higher-end products and is increasing prices by more modest amounts on lower-priced entry-level items. Structural Systems Repair Group, a Cincinnati-based construction company, is taking a 10 to 15% increase in prices that will show up in new contracts this year. SSRG typically absorbs increases in materials costs totaling 5% or less, but tariffs pushed steel prices up by 10% last year, said Brian Erickson, the company's president. SSRG's healthcare costs for its 115 employees increased by a similar amount, he said. It's not sustainable for us to tolerate that kind of increase without some sort of concession from our customers, said Erickson, whose company adapts and maintains parking garages, stadiums, and other structures. Higher costs can be particularly challenging for small businesses, which typically have thinner profit margins than big companies and fewer ways to offset expenses. By raising prices, companies risk turning off buyers. When tariffs prompted Stanley Black & Decker to raise prices last year by the high single digits on average, sales fell in the U.S., particularly for lower-priced items. The hardware company is looking at selective discounts, Chief Financial Officer Patrick Hallinan told analysts during an earnings call this month. Sinn, a company that makes housewares and lighting in Brooklyn, New York, is archiving items such as a ceramic planter that costs $450 because it doesn't believe customers will pay more and is raising prices across its entire lineup. "We try to absorb rising costs whenever we can," said company owner Virginia Sinn. Yet, the company, which usually raised prices on only a handful of items each January, took the across-the-board price increases because wages, material costs, shipping, and other expenses have climbed. Starting wages for new employees and training rose 20% between 2022 and 2025. Many businesses have tried to offset tariffs and other inflationary pressures through cost-cutting and by pushing back on suppliers, but some companies said those options alone weren't enough. Tariff expenses added $70 million in gross costs last year and will add $50 million in incremental costs this year, according to spice maker McCormick. The company raised some prices in September in response to tariffs, inflation in core commodities, and higher packaging costs, and it is increasing some more prices this month. "Our pricing actions have been surgical," Chief Executive Brendan Foley told analysts last month. More than half of small business leaders said they plan to increase prices in the next 3 months, according to a December survey of 600 entrepreneurs by Vistage Worldwide. Nearly 70% planned increases of 4 to 10%, while an additional 10% forecast increases of more than 10%, according to the business coaching and peer advisory firm. Atomic Object, a Grand Rapids, Michigan-based digital software consultant, raised the hourly rate it charges its customers to $200 this year, after boosting rates to $195 an hour from $180 an hour at the end of 2024. "We tested the market at $195 and said we'd hold here," said Jeff Williams, a managing partner. "But increases in salaries and benefits are driving expenses higher and higher." The company's health insurance premiums jumped by 14% this year after climbing by 12% in 2025, and now equal nearly 10% of revenue, up from 5% 3 years ago. And that's companies beset by costs are jacking up prices again. Our next article, turnover in CEOs is most in over a decade. Companies are changing bosses more often and hiring younger ones. This is by Theo Francis. About one in CEO in nine was replaced last year across 1,500 publicly traded companies. Faster CEO turnover at U.S. public companies has put the biggest class of incoming chief executives in years at the helm of massive enterprises, and the newcomers are younger and less experienced than before. About one CEO in nine was replaced last year across 1,500 of the biggest publicly traded companies, a new analysis finds. That is the highest rate since at least 2010, when the U.S. was emerging from the financial crisis. Pace doesn't appear to be slowing. Dozens more companies brought in new CEOs in January, early February, including Walmart, Procter & Gamble, and Lululemon Athletica. On a single day in early February, Disney, PayPal, and HP announced new CEOs, and last week Kroger named a former Walmart executive to head the grocer. The result is a grand experiment in leadership as companies grapple with the swift rise of artificial intelligence, the unraveling of long-established trade practices, and an unsettled economy and geopolitical order. We're in a new environment, and someone who's going to replay the playbooks of the past is not necessarily right, said James Citrin, head of the global CEO practice at executive recruiting firm Spencer Stuart, which produced the report. If the CEO doesn't get momentum, both internally with operating performance and also with investors, then boards are more impatient than they ever were. Many of the issues they face are a departure from conventional business challenges. Target CEO Michael Fiddleke took over at Target from 11-year veteran Brian Cornell this month. but he found himself posting a video message to employees days before addressing federal immigration actions in the company's hometown, Minneapolis. "This isn't the first message I'd imagined I'd send," he said. In the last quarter of 2025 alone, companies with a combined market capitalization of $1.3 trillion appointed or lost chiefs, including Verizon Communications and Yum Brands, the parent of fast food chains KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. Companies adding or losing leaders in early 2026 have a combined value of $2.2 trillion, with Walmart making up nearly half, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of data from corporate disclosure firm MyLogIQ. Some changes were long in the works. Warren Buffett turned Berkshire Hathaway over to Greg Abel on January 1st, a succession plan Buffett raised in 2021. Other changes were more sudden. CarMax ousted Bill Nash in November amid a slump in sales, ending his 9-year run. HP picked director Bruce Broussard as interim CEO after Enrique Lores stepped down to take a top job at PayPal next month. Biotech firm Codexis abruptly replaced its CEO of 3 years with its chief technical officer, Allison Moore, and cut 24% of its workforce at the same time. Especially in retail, the crosscurrents buffeting companies since the pandemic demand different approaches, said Adolfo Villagomez, who took the helm of 1-800-Flowers.com from its founder in May. "It's a very different skill profile when you have growth as a tailwind versus when you have a lot of headwinds and you need to reinvent the company," said Villagomez, who previously ran a residential rental company and held executive positions at Home Depot. "That's why you see a lot of change. There are signs this is more than the normal ebb and flow of executive reshuffling. Recent high-profile departures include long-tenured executives, including Walmart's Doug McMillon after more than a decade, and Buffett after 6 decades. But incumbent CEOs are generally stepping down sooner than they traditionally have. Meanwhile, incoming chiefs are younger and less experienced than previous crops of new leaders, Spencer Stewart found. Incoming CEOs average 54 years old, compared with nearly 56 for last year's appointees. More than 80% of last year's 168 incoming CEOs were first-timers with no prior experience running public companies or other major standalone enterprises. 2/3 of them have never served on a corporate board before. Some, like Raymond James's Paul Schauke, are younger than their predecessors were when they got the top job. The financial services firm promoted Schauke, 42, from CFO to CEO last February. He succeeded Paul Reilly, who was 55 when he became CEO in 2010. Executives who haven't run a standalone company aren't necessarily untested. Joss DiAmaro, the 55-year-old Disney executive slated to take over from Bob Iger next month, has been running the company's theme park and cruise unit with $36 billion in annual revenue and 185,000 employees worldwide. "Younger makes sense to me given the changes in the world," said Cindy Jameson, a longtime turnaround executive who sits on boards, including Darden Restaurants and International Flavors and Fragrances. "Things are shifting and changing very dramatically and permanently, and you want people who've been in the trenches facing these decisions." When companies did bring in older and more experienced chiefs, it often reflected a scramble in tough circumstances. More companies choose a board member to run things day-to-day last year, usually a stopgap move that suggests succession hadn't gone as planned, Spencer Stewart said. That includes 15% of incoming tech, media, and telecom CEOs. New female CEOs grew scarcer last year. Just 9% of new appointments went to women, down from 15% a year earlier. Overall, about 9% of CEOs in the S&P 1500 are women, including 46 in the S&P 500, Spencer Stewart said. That's turnover in CEOs is most in over a decade. Our next article, Farmers are aging. The family business is in peril. Rising costs, weak prices, and a trade hit are pushing more farms to the brink, making it harder to find successors. This article is by Patrick Thomas, Marshall, Illinois. Don Gunip is running out of time. The fifth-generation farmer still wakes early each morning to tend to roughly 1,000 acres of corn and soybeans and 40 cattle. But 4 decades of grueling work, a bout with prostate cancer, and surgery to replace both of his hips with titanium implants have taken their toll. The 74-year-old estimates he can maintain the current workload for a couple more years. Under the gaze of generations of Gunips in black and white photos, he gathers his 4 siblings to chart the future of their family's farm and contemplates a day when a Gunip no longer cares for the land that runs along Gunip Road. The natural choice to take over, his son and daughter left for college and now work in corporate fields. His siblings made the same decision years earlier. It's disappointing to me, Gunip says, holding back tears. That's the way the dice were rolled, and you have to accept what life gives you. The number of farmers in America has been shrinking for years, but rising costs and weak commodity prices are pushing more families out at a faster rate. In 2025, 315 farms filed for bankruptcy, up 46% from 2024, U.S. court data shows. Those left are aging. There are more farmers 75 and older than under the age of 35, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They're facing tough choices and tougher prospects. The family agriculture is in crisis, and American farmers and ranchers are fighting for their livelihoods, says National Farmers Union President Rob LaRue. Many farmers already rely on government bailouts to stay afloat. In 2024, Congress approved $10 billion in bailout funds and $21 billion in natural disaster relief for growers and ranchers. The Trump administration's trade policies exacerbated the situation, pushing more families and communities to the brink. In December, the White House pledged $12 billion in aid to farmers. Thousands across the U.S. are closing the book on farms that have been in their families for generations, either by selling to a larger entity or declaring bankruptcy. It's transformed food production in local communities. Critics of farm consolidation say it's also led to less crop diversity, presenting risks for the broader food system. The disappearance of small farms has carried steep consequences for rural America, upending the transfer of wealth between generations, and the tough economics are making the search for successors more challenging. Children of farmers today have more opportunities to work beyond agriculture, and families are typically smaller, shrinking the pool of candidates. Seated around the living room, Gunip and his siblings discuss plans for land potentially worth millions of dollars. While Gunip has sole oversight of the acres and animals, his parents left the family farm in trusts that split ownership between him, David, Susan, Sally, and Dan. Every year, Gunip pays his siblings rent based on the farm's performance. The profits aren't much, but it could be worse. One thing that helps, Gunip is frugal. He still lives in the more than century-old house his grandfather built. His truck, which recently lost power steering, is from the 1990s. Instead of buying new equipment and hiring help, he uses an aging tractor and combine. "Why would I buy new equipment if I have no one to pass it along to?" he says. On Gunip Road. With calls of "Suic calf," Gunip starts the day the same way his father and grandfather did before him. He treks the gravel path behind the farmhouse to a small pasture tucked between rows of corn and soybeans. One by one, cattle fall behind him single file to consume a breakfast of ground corn and hay. Gunip handles just about every task around the farm. He hauls buckets of feed into the back of his ATV and unloads them in a pen crowded with cattle. With the hip replacements, he's limber enough to climb into the large machinery needed to harvest crops, spray pesticides, plant seeds, and move hay bales that weigh roughly 1,000 pounds each. Reminders of his lineage dot the land, starting with signs in front of the farm pointing to the start, 1837. Family patriarch Joseph Ginnup left Steuben County, New York, in the 1830s and settled 40 acres of land in southeastern Illinois, where he built a log cabin, the family's first farmhouse. The land has passed through every generation since. Ginnup's father Robert and mother Rose eventually took their turn at the helm. With Ginnup being the eldest child, there wasn't much question who'd take over the farm. Dad just really groomed him to take over, said Dan, a former cruise line accounting chief who lives in California. It was pretty obvious. Ginnup graduated from Southern Illinois University in 1973 with a teaching degree. He briefly worked as an agriculture teacher before returning to the farm. Before Robert Ginnup died in the 1990s, he and his wife put the farm into two trusts that would be shared equally between their five children when they died. His vision, Don Ginnup says, was that whoever stayed on the farm would buy out the others. The land was worth about $1,000 to $2,000 an acre back then. It's 10 times that now, making it impossible for Ginnup to buy out all of his siblings. The farmer isn't one to complain, his daughter says. He's never asked for help. It's just the way it is, he'll say when asked about the structure. When their mother died in 2024, Ginnup and his siblings agreed to keep the trust as is and figure out the rest later. Ginnup's son, Andy, was raised to be the farm's sixth-generation operator. It was always assumed since I was the boy, Andy says. I don't think we ever had conversations about it. He learned the ropes early and spent his childhood cleaning grain bins, baling hay, and feeding the livestock. But farm work was a bore. Andy was more drawn to the animals than to the crops. He can't recall when he told his dad he wasn't interested in a career in agriculture, but it was likely around high school. After graduating from college, he spent a year helping out on the farm while his father recovered from surgery for prostate cancer. Once Don Ginnup was able to return to work, Andy headed west for a pharmaceutical job in St. Louis. His sister, Molly Wedding, a lawyer for an insurer, lives in Indianapolis with her husband and three children. She had no interest in living her life out in a small town. She says her father also never tried to convince her to take over the farm. As she's grown older, she's developed a greater interest in the farm's business operations. Could I run it? Yes. Do I see myself doing the labor myself? No. She's encouraged her father to have more serious conversations about succession planning. The shareholders. Don Ginnup convenes his siblings at the farm in mid-October, peak harvest season. It's the first time they've met since the blur of weeks around their mother's death. We've had 3 good years on the farm, Ginnup tells his siblings, sounding like a chairman talking to his board. Can't say that about this year. Prices are bad and the crops are bad, so your income this year is going to be down. They nod their heads. They've seen the news about the trade war and the other difficulties hitting the farm. Susan, who's married to a retired farmer in Indiana, knows them firsthand. Going into the meeting, everyone thought David was close to selling his stake. They had agreed that if a sibling wants to cash out, the remaining owners would buy their share to prevent the farm from being sold to outsiders. But when Ginnup asked David if he wants to sell his share, David shakes his head no. What do you want to do? Susan asks in surprise. David proposes dividing the farmland and passing the parcels to each of their children. That way, he says, the children won't have to fight over future decisions regarding the entire farm. Frustrated, Dan and Susan argue his plan isn't feasible. Hills and dense trees make some of the land difficult to farm. Which of their children would get the land with the hills, and which would get the most productive ground? Susan suggests they consider reorganizing the farm as a limited liability company. The structure would make it easier to manage as a business, she says, and more straightforward for future generations, allowing the siblings to transfer shares rather than physical acreage. Dan and Sally don't think changes are needed. The current structure is working. Addressing the other big question mark, what happens when Don retires, Sally says she believes the best path forward is to lease the land to an outside, trusted farmer. Don Ginnup spends most of the back and forth listening. When he does speak, his family listens, especially when Ginnup tells them he thinks he can keep farming for about 2 more years. I'm healthy, I like what I'm doing, he says, but I'm not going to live forever. He suggests they look at putting 40 acres into a USDA program that removes it from production and provides growers with a fixed payment for the farmland. They agree. After 2 hours, it's clear that will be the only decision today. The siblings acknowledge they should meet twice a year as they break for lunch. Ginnip won't be able to join them for long. A truckload of freshly harvested soybeans needs his attention. The farm calls. At the local grain elevator, Ginnip is offered about $10 a bushel for his soybeans. It isn't enough to make a large profit, but he knows it's better than what some growers are getting. His 600 bushels will likely end up in poultry feed in the South. On the drive back, he reflects on the meeting. He says the family usually reaches the right decision after they've had time to think about it. The future of American farming isn't pretty, in Ginnip's view. He predicts it will resemble a contract model in which farmers work the land for someone else, pay rent, and are personally responsible for the debt incurred to keep the farm running. Fewer family farmers will exist. The pride they brought will be lost, too. When farmers owned the land and lived on the land, they took care of the land, and they formed communities that worked together and solved problems and took care of everybody, he says. You're not going to have that in the future. The future preoccupying him right now, though, is the 2026 harvest. Just before Christmas, Ginnip tallies his expenses and sets aside money for taxes and expenses for the coming year's crop. He mails checks totaling several thousand dollars apiece to each of his siblings. He managed to earn a profit in 2025, but sold his soybean crop for about $60,000 less than last year. He's applying for some of the bailout money promised by the Trump administration. The funds will help cover fertilizer, pesticides, and seeds to help plant new crops in the spring. New equipment isn't on the list. As farmers are aging, the family business is in peril. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona and the programming like the Wall Street Journal on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show as it streams. But if you'd like to listen to the stream or programming at a time of your choosing, you can go to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone, or from the Google Play Store for your Android tablet or phone. Well, let's turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal. We have these headlines. Investors learn to handle surprise. Goldman to scrap DEI criteria for board. And Detroit's EV pullback is costing $50 billion. That first headline, investors learn to handle surprise, unexpected events that swing markets have become a trading fixture. This is by Xavier Martinez. Tariffs, AI innovations, pressure on the Federal Reserve, the Venezuela incursion. A year into the second Trump administration, traders and investors say they're growing more accustomed to what is known in Wall Street parlance as event risk. Sudden, unexpected news triggering outsized market swings. Market-moving shifts from Washington once involved months of negotiation with stakeholders, members of Congress, and lobbyists. Today, they're just as likely to come via overnight headlines or social media posts that can add or erase billions of dollars in market value before breakfast. Lately, they range from the potential scaling back of steel tariffs to the appointment of a new Federal Reserve chairman. Developments in artificial intelligence disrupted entire sectors of the market in sudden and unexpected ways, rolling through insurers, data providers, wealth managers, and trucking companies in recent sessions. Stocks remain near record highs, but the all-hours cadence spurred some investors to move money into foreign markets or other havens to escape the noise of the domestic headline cycle. Stephen Colano, Chief Investment Officer at Integrated Partners, is looking toward regions where trade relationships are being formed independently of Washington, such as the European Union and India, increasing allocations to European defense companies and emerging market equities. You almost get desensitized to it, he said, to expect what's not expected. Along with the unexpected, investors in the current holiday shortened week are preparing to parse data on economic growth and the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, along with earnings from Walmart, auto seller Carvana, and equipment maker Deere. The nerves are evident from increases in the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, known as Wall Street's fear gauge because it measures the price of options that investors tend to buy when expecting stock swings. The median daily absolute move on the index has climbed to 4.2% from 3.5% during the last year of former President Joe Biden's term, according to FactSet data. The index closed at 20 or above on 66 days in the first year of President Trump's second term, compared with 0 times in the first year of his first term, according to SM 500 Research. Index values below 20 generally suggest market stability. This earnings season has been particularly volatile. The average S&P stock moved 5.2% or more on reporting days, the highest since 2012, according to Citi Analysts. 15 moved 15% or more. Meanwhile, event-driven swings continue. An update from a small logistics company sparked a rout in trucking stocks last week when investors worried that shippers would be the next industry disrupted by new AI tools. C.H. Robinson fell 15%. It isn't just stocks. Trade wars, deficit spending, and a falling dollar helped. Gold prices surge 65% in 2025 and to records above $5,300 a troy ounce in January. Then, the sudden nomination of Kevin Warsh to succeed Jerome Powell as Fed chair triggered a dollar rally that sent gold sliding. Brent Donnelly, president of Spectra Markets, pointed to an uptick in pension funds increasing protections against extreme moves in the dollar to mitigate the risk of the currency dropping on a sudden headline. Case in point, last month, Trump's comment that he wasn't concerned about a retreat in the U.S. currency sparked the dollar's biggest decline since his April tariff announcement. You can't possibly know when it's going to happen, and you won't know if it's credible when it does, Donnelly said. In January alone, investors were surprised by the military operation in Venezuela, a proposal to cap credit card interest rates at 10%, a directive to housing giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy $200 billion of mortgage bonds, and Japanese policy shifts that sparked a bond market sell-off. PIMCO's Mark Seidner and Pramil Dhawan wrote in a recent report. They recommended that investors adopt an agile mindset built for uncertainty, tracking valuations, staying flexible across regions, and reacting quickly when volatility creates opportunities. That's investors learn to handle surprise. Anna Maria Andriotis writes our next article, Goldman to Scrap DEI Criteria for Board. Last year, Goldman Sachs dropped a commitment to support board diversity for clients it was taking public. Now it plans to drop diversity criteria for its own board. The Wall Street Bank is preparing to remove race, gender identity, sexual orientation, and other diversity factors from the criteria its board will consider when identifying potential candidates, according to people familiar with the matter. The board's governance committee currently finds qualified candidates based primarily on 4 factors, one of which is a broad description of diversity such as viewpoints, background, work, and military service, in addition to other demographics that includes a list of DEI factors. Now it plans to cross off the other demographics, including race, gender identity, ethnicity, and sexual orientation, the people said. Goldman's decision followed a behind-the-scenes request from the conservative activist nonprofit National Legal and Policy Center, which owns a small stake in the bank. The group submitted a proposal to the firm in September seeking to remove the DEI criteria, the people said. The group requested its proposal be included in Goldman's proxy statement that will be circulated to shareholders before the firm's annual shareholder meeting. Goldman informed the NLPC that it plans to remove the DEI criteria, and an agreement was signed between the two parties that also includes the activist group withdrawing its proposal. Goldman's board is expected to approve the new language this month, the people said. NLPC has argued to several companies that factoring in diversity when identifying individuals qualified to be board members raises the risk of discrimination. Goldman, like many large banks, has pulled back on DEI efforts over the past year. It retooled its diversity program, 1 Million Black Women, a multi-billion dollar commitment to invest in black businesswomen and nonprofit leaders, including removing references to race. It also ended its requirement that companies in the U.S. and Western Europe have diverse boards for the bank to take them public. And that's Goldman to scrap DEI criteria for board. Next, we have Detroit's EV pullback is costing $50 billion. This is by Nate Ratner, Terrell Wright, and Sharon Turlip. The costs are piling up as U.S. automakers are pulling back on their electric vehicle business. Following years of investments into EV technology, Detroit's Big Three, General Motors, Ford Motor, and Stellantis, have announced more than $50 billion in combined write-downs. EV sales fell more than 30% in the fourth quarter after the $7,500 federal tax credit that had juiced U.S. sales expired in September. Since then, demand has cratered for the highest-profile EVs, such as Tesla's Cybertruck and Ford's electric pickup. Automakers expect demand to remain muted this year. GM is forging ahead with much of its EV strategy at a smaller scale after writing down $6 billion in January. The company, for instance, still aims to build big EV trucks. Ford, meanwhile, is changing course after a $19.5 billion charge in December. Instead of plowing billions into the future, knowing these large EVs will never make money, we're pivoting, Ford Chief Executive Jim Farley has said. Ford now said it will make one low-cost EV pickup by 2027. Automakers' retreats and massive write-downs have come as Republican lawmakers abolished the federal tax credit for EVs last fall, while also doing away with federal fuel efficiency mandates. Even with federal support, EV demand was below expectations. Now, auto companies and battery makers are scaling back. After pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into U.S. manufacturing, they're downsizing investments, canceling projects, and pivoting plants to support making more traditional gas-powered vehicles. Net effect of all the cancellations? More than $20 billion in previously announced investments in EV and battery facilities were wiped out last year, according to Atlas Public Policy, which tracks clean economy investments. That drove the first net annual decrease in announced investments in years. GM laid off thousands of workers at plants across Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee and has dropped plans for factories to make EV trucks and motors. Instead, those plants will build gas-powered trucks and V8 engines. Ford dissolved a joint venture with a South Korean conglomerate to make EV batteries in America. Stellantis is unloading its stake in a battery-making business. When Stellantis booked a $26 billion write-down this month, the largest charge taken by any automaker related to electric vehicle bets so far, Chief Executive Antonio Filosa said the pace of the energy transition had been overestimated and distanced us from many car buyers' real-world needs, means, and desires. Outside of the U.S., EV markets have been growing. China's BYD recently replaced Tesla as the world's biggest EV seller, even though some countries have put tariffs on Chinese EVs. BYD delivered more than 1 million vehicles outside of China last year, double what it delivered in 2024. But at home, its sales growth slowed amid steeper competition and a reduction in state subsidies for affordable vehicles. Next, Detroit's EV pullback is costing $50 billion. We'll turn now to Micron spends big on giant chip plants. This is by Robbie Whalen, Boise, Idaho. Every day around 4:30 p.m., the ground here shakes from controlled explosions to flatten out the ground underneath a gigantic new semiconductor factory. Micron Technology is the largest American maker of memory chips, which help power everything from smartphones and car computers to laptops and data centers. Micron is rushing to add manufacturing capacity to avert the biggest supply crunch the industry has seen in more than 40 years. In Boise, where the company is based, Micron is spending $50 billion to more than double the size of its 450-acre campus, including the construction of two new chip factories, or fabs. The first fab's inaugural silicon wafers are expected to roll off the factory line in mid-2027, making DRAM, a type of memory used to make the high-bandwidth memory chips, or HBM, that are essential to advanced artificial intelligence. Both plants should be in production by the end of 2028. Each fab will be 600,000 square feet, making them some of the biggest clean rooms ever built in America. Each Boise fab is expected to use 70,000 tons of steel and 300,000 cubic yards of concrete, enough for four Empire State Buildings. That's not all. Near Syracuse, Micron just broke ground on a $100 billion fab complex that represents the state of New York's largest ever private investment. Late last year, Micron announced a $9.6 billion fab investment in Hiroshima, Japan, while competitor SK Hynix said in January that it would build a $13 billion fab in South Korea, in addition to a $4 billion complex in Indiana. Behind the manufacturing arms race is the AI boom. As firms such as OpenAI, Oracle, xAI, and Anthropic unveil plans to build trillions of dollars of data centers, demand has far outpaced capacity in the memory chip market. That's because the processors designed by companies including NVIDIA, Google, Broadcom, and Advanced Micro Devices require more and faster memory chips for model training and inference, or the process of responding to queries. I've been here for 28 years and I've never seen anything so disruptive as AI, said Scott Gatzmeier, the Micron vice president heading its $200 billion U.S. expansion. As we started to transfer from training to inference, the amount of data required just exploded, and we just didn't have enough clean room capacity to satisfy demand. The shortages resulted in a gold rush for memory chip manufacturers like Micron and its two biggest competitors, SK Hynix and Samsung. Since April of last year, Micron's share price has risen more than sixfold to around $414, making the company worth nearly $500 billion. As the company shifted away from simpler memory chips that go in mobile and other devices and toward more profitable products such as data center HBM chips, its gross margin shot up as well from 18.5% in early 2024 to 56% in its most recent quarterly report. The company said it expects gross margins in the current quarter to hit 68%, approaching the more than 73% that NVIDIA earns on sales of its flagship products known as graphics processing units, or GPUs. Our business is on an extraordinary trajectory, said Mark Murphy, Micron's chief financial officer, at an investor conference on Wednesday. Murphy said Micron is currently able to meet about one-half to two-thirds of demand for some key customers. Increasingly, buyers are approaching the company seeking to lock in multi-year purchasing contracts to ensure supply and attempt to avoid dramatic price increases. On the supply side, we're doing everything we can to add capacity, he said, but there's no easy or fast way to get that done. Starting in 2024, the rapid rise of AI caused a surge in demand for memory. Between August and October, as AI model developers, cloud services companies, and hyperscalers announced project after enormous project, Micron started noticing HBM demand was going through the roof, said Sumit Sadana, its chief business officer. The company was already hard at work building ID1, short for Idaho 1, at its first of two enormous new fabs in Boise. Micron decided to accelerate work on ID2, the second fab. Memory has gone from being a system component to being a strategic asset, Sadana said. In early February, Micron's share price briefly took a hit after SemiAnalysis, an influential chips industry research shop, reported that Micron's latest AI memory chips, known as HBM4, failed to win a spot as a supplier for NVIDIA's newest generation of AI servers, which launched this year. The report suggested NVIDIA was unhappy with the speed of Micron's chips and decided to go with other suppliers. NVIDIA declined to comment. Sadana said the reports were inaccurate and that Micron's already making customer shipments of HBM4 and expects to ship more next quarter. Supplies of HBM4 and HBM3E, the previous generation of high-bandwidth memory chips, are sold out through the end of this year, he added. And that's Micron spends big on giant chip plants. Patrick Thomas writes our next article, Smithfield plans to build its first new pork plant in decades. Smithfield Foods plans to build a large hog slaughterhouse in South Dakota, marking the first new facility built by America's top pork producer in decades. Virginia-based Smithfield said it will spend about $1.3 billion over 3 years on a new facility in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. When in operation, the plant's expected to employ about 3,000 workers and be able to slaughter about 20,000 hogs a day. The new project replaces Smithfield's existing more than 100-year-old facility in the city. The company slaughters nearly 30 million hogs a year and is a major supplier of ham, bacon, and other pork products to grocers. Its plans come a year after its return to U.S. public markets. Smithfield's stock is up nearly 20% since the listing. The U.S. meat industry in general is older and dated, Smithfield Chief Executive Officer Shane Smith said in an interview. I think this sends a signal that we are in the pork industry for the long term. We're not going anywhere. The project could face scrutiny from U.S. officials concerned about foreign ownership of meat production and agricultural land. Since 2013, Smithfield has been a subsidiary of Chinese pork company WH Group. At that time, the $4.7 billion deal was one of the largest takeovers of a U.S. company by a Chinese firm. The ownership of Smithfield and its U.S. assets has drawn scrutiny from lawmakers and the Trump administration. The company has said it's investing in the U.S. and denied accusations that its decisions are influenced by the Chinese government. Do I expect to hear some noise? Probably. But do I think it should rise to the level where it's an issue? I don't think so, Smith said, especially again if people look at this objectively. Founded in 1936, Smithfield helped pioneer the methods that made the U.S. a global pork powerhouse. The new South Dakota plant will expand its packaged meats production, a priority for Smithfield's CEO. It would be the second largest for Smithfield in the U.S., behind its Tar Heel, North Carolina facility, the world's largest pork processing facility by volume. Construction of a new meatpacking facility would follow several recent plant closures. Tyson's Foods closed one of its largest beef processing plants in Lexington, Nebraska, which employed 3,200 people, and cut production at a Texas facility in half. JBS and Cargill have said they are closing smaller processing facilities in recent weeks. New meatpacking plants at the scale Smithfield is planning are rare. Besides being costly, the projects have historically faced criticism from local residents and environmentalists. Over the past year, JBS, the world's largest meatpacker and Smithfield's top pork rival, has said it's expanding its pork operations in response to Americans' growing appetite for protein. The company has announced plans to build two new sausage facilities in Iowa. Smithfield has also closed facilities over the past few years, including a plant in California and smaller processing operations that package meat for grocery stores. The company said the new facility will run more efficiently than other plants, featuring advanced automation technology and a streamlined design. Smithfield and other meatpackers have been spending billions of dollars to automate the grueling, sometimes dangerous work required in meat processing facilities. Work on the site is expected to begin this spring. Smithfield plans to formally break ground on construction in the first half of 2027 and begin production at the end of 2028. And that Smithfield plans to build its first new pork plant in decades. Well, let's turn now to the Herd on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal, financial analysis and commentary. And our first item there is drug makers face Napster-like reckoning. Free-for-all era of copycat weight loss drugs is ending, but will likely morph into something else. Napster forever changed the music industry, even though its business model was ultimately deemed illegal. Could a similar change be sweeping through America's drug market? The Trump administration this month took a hardline stance against telehealth company Hims & Hers Health, with its health agency referring to the telehealth firm to the Justice Department for potential federal violations. The rampant compounding of GLP-1 drugs, by which pharmacies essentially sell knockoffs of the same active ingredients, isn't going away quickly, but doing it on a massive scale now feels far more precarious. Novo Nordisk is suing Hims & Hers, alleging violations of the patents covering Ozempic and Wegovy. Wall Street is taking notice. Hims & Hers shares have fallen nearly 30% since the Trump administration's move. The bigger question now is how the market will evolve and what ripple effects this shift will have beyond GLP-1s. The music industry offers a useful parallel. For decades, record labels reigned, despite the occasional bootleg tape. Then Napster arrived with online file sharing. Suddenly, it felt as though all the world's music was permanently free to anyone with an internet connection. That model didn't last. Lawsuits eventually drove Napster into bankruptcy, and the era of totally free music came to an end. But the genie was out of the bottle. Once consumers experienced instant, frictionless access to music, there was no going back. The result was a new generation of applications. The first iTunes, then Spotify, where content was paid for, but the convenience remained. Pharma now faces a similar transformation. An aggressive FDA crackdown may finally rein in mass GLP-1 compounding, but history suggests this is only a bridge to a different kind of disruption. Drug companies sell most of their medicines through a web of middlemen, wholesalers, pharmacy benefit managers, and insurers that use inflated list prices and rebate schemes. The system is so opaque that even employers and the government struggle to see how prices are actually set. Over time, these middlemen have built vertically integrated structures designed to extract value from America's uniquely convoluted drug distribution model. That system is being challenged, and the direct-to-consumer model for weight loss drugs offers a glimpse of what could come next. GLP-1s are a special case. Patients are willing to pay cash and bypass insurance altogether. But the broader movement toward price transparency and patient empowerment is accelerating in different corners of healthcare. Examples include Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drugs, which offers drug prices at a transparent low price, and Thatch, which helps employees navigate insurance to choose better plans. Together, these sorts of startups shift power back to consumers. The Hims & Hers strategy of undercutting patented drugs arguably went too far and always seemed like a mirage as far as strategy goes. Mass compounding was allowed only because of a drug shortage that was bound to be resolved, as it was last year. We're told this isn't really mass compounding, says Mike Doustdar, chief executive of Novo Nordisk, and in an interview last week. I say, you have a Super Bowl ad. This is crazy. At some point, they have to ask themselves, do they want to be Napster or Spotify? Roe, a competitor to Hims, points to a different path. Rather than leaning on legally murky, high-margin compounded drugs, Roe acts as a telehealth gateway for branded medications. Roe also sold compounded GLP-1s during the shortages, but both Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk now sell their drugs on the platform. As CEO Zach Raitano explains, too many problems in our healthcare system exist because the patient does not control the flow of money at the point of purchase. When they do, the system rewires itself. For now, much of this change is still confined to GLP-1s, not the drugs most people buy with insurance. Even Trump Rx, an online drug portal launched just as regulators were cracking down on Hims and Hers, offers only a narrow set of medications at prices few people can realistically pay in cash. The bulk of the system still flows through large drug distributors and dominant pharmacy benefit managers. But that system's under pressure. Just this month, two major policy changes, long in the making, happened rather quietly. The Federal Trade Commission attempted to dismantle key pillars of the PBM rebate model in a recent settlement with Cigna's Express Scripts, while Congress enacted legislation as part of the recent government funding bill that should reduce the relationship between drug prices and what PBMs earn. PBMs have long feared these moves and have thus been changing the way patients pay for drugs. The FTC settlement even forces Express Scripts to give members access to Trump Rx pricing. Much more disruption is yet to come to healthcare, both from governments and businesses. As Raitano puts it, GLP-1s reveal what happens when the patient is also the customer. Imagine if the rest of healthcare had to operate under the same rules. David Wehner wrote that article, Drug Makers Face Napster-like Reckoning. Well, this is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and remind you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, sunsounds.org, or you can download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. That's now available at the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. Finally, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.